Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara-Byrne. Tonight, she was a trailblazer and a superstar, storming into the stuffy, male-dominated world of chess in the early 60s. Lisa Lane passed away recently at the age of 90. Two-time U.S. women's chess champion and author Jennifer Shahadeh joins me to explain her incredible legacy. Could we be about to find out who the next James Bond will be? Reports out of the UK say Aaron Taylor-Johnson of Nocturnal Animals and Avengers fame will be the seventh 007 after Daniel Craig hung up his license to kill after 16 years. So why is Taylor-Johnson the favorite, and what will they need to do to keep the famous Bond franchise new and relevant? The U.S. Department of Justice is looking to take a big bite out of Apple. The DOJ and 16 state attorneys general have filed an antitrust lawsuit against the company, saying its strict restrictions against third-party technology forces consumers and developers to only use items under Apple's umbrella. So what could it mean for Apple, and what could it mean for Canadian consumers? But first, Prime Minister Brian Mulroney continues to lie in repose at St. Patrick's Basilica in downtown Montreal ahead of a state funeral on Saturday. His longtime personal photographer, Bill McCarthy, was invited back by the Mulroney family to capture this week in photos both in Ottawa and in Montreal. And he joins me to talk about his many memories of his days with the Prime Minister and what he's witnessed over this week. Let's begin this evening in Montreal. The bells of St. Patrick's Basilica rang out in downtown Montreal this morning as Brian Mulroney's funeral cortege arrived at the historic church. Mila Mulroney and her children, Caroline, Ben, Mark, and Nicholas, stood behind the hearse and watched as the casket bearing the former prime minister was carried inside. The family greeted a line of dignitaries and invited guests inside the historic basilica. Former Quebec premier and Bloc Québécois leader Lucien Bouchard was among the first in line to pay his respects. He was a cabinet minister in Mulroney's Progressive Conservative government until a falling out over the Constitution. He told reporters that he had reconciled with Mulroney before his death last month, but he regretted the years of long estrangement.
A reopening would happen. It did happen. And those were great times, but sad in the same time because we had lost so much time. And you can't help thinking, if we would go back then, maybe we would be a bit better to manage this thing, you know. But we are young.
Brian Mulroney, of course, passed away on February 29th at the age of 84. Former Quebec Premier Jean Charest told reporters outside the church that this is a very sad moment, but that it's beautiful in some ways as well, as all Canadians reflect on Brian Mulroney's legacy.
These moments in the life of Canada are important, and I sincerely hope that a lot of Canadians will take a moment to stop and reflect and think about what we've built together and the very important role that Brian Mulroney has played.
Mr. Mulroney will lie in repose at St. Patrick's again tomorrow. His state funeral, of course, will be held Saturday morning at nearby Notre Dame Basilica in Montreal, there to witness what happened in Ottawa earlier this week, what happened today in Montreal. And for the funeral is Bill McCarthy, who was the Prime Minister's official photographer for 5 years, and he captured more than a few historical moments, from Nelson Mandela's visit to Canada after his release to the Prime Minister negotiating over free trade, as well as candid moments between Mr. Mulroney and other world leaders such as Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr. and Margaret Thatcher. But his favorite moments were those he witnessed between Mr. Mulroney and his family. And it was that connection to the family, one that endures, that sees him back behind the lens for these historic days as loved ones and a country pay their respects and say farewell. And Bill McCarthy joins me now from Montreal. Thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you very much, Ben. I'm very happy to be with you.
I was just wondering what it's like to have been invited back to photograph these last few days and what's ahead. What an honor for you, and what a way to sort of close out this very touching chapter of your life and of Mr. Mulroney's.
Well, it's you just described it perfectly. It's a great honor. I've always been very fond of the family, and it's been quite mutual. So when I was asked to do this, I literally broke into tears. It means a great deal to me. And, you know, here I am back with the family, and it's just the most wonderful thing in the world. There's been a lot of tears this week, but there's also been a lot of laughter.
Yeah, I've been watching some of the images emerging from that. It's always amazing to see the people who come out and the stories they share, and just the images that you've captured too. It's been a very touching few days, and I know I've no doubt it will continue.
Well, the thing about the images that people would have seen over the last few weeks, I guess, they come from the fact that I was given unlimited access to Mr. Mulroney and his family. And he was very clear when I first started with him that, you know, you will respect my family's privacy, right? Of course I will. And that's all he had to say to me. Now, I was born that way anyway. I would behave that way. But once that was said and on the table, he literally ignored me for 5 years. And that meaning I was always in a room, but he would always forget I was there. And I would walk in and out of a room when I wanted. I was in the corner all the time. And it didn't matter what the conversation was. It just carried on with a foreign leader or with the mayor of Campbell River, BC, or a president of the United States. The conversations always carried on because he gave me his total trust. But in terms of conversations, he and I probably spoke twice a week, which was Monday morning. Hey, good morning, Billy. Have a good weekend. Yes, sir, I did. And then Thursday afternoon it would be, oh, Billy, I'm not coming in tomorrow, so I'll see you. I'll see you at 24 Sussex. But even at that, at 24 Sussex, he just kind of nodded to me, and he would do the meetings that he was doing, and I would just come and go. So it's a great honor to have anybody trust you. I think in any daily life, when people trust you, that's a very big deal, and you should never lose that trust. And when I left the office, the last day I was with him, I told him that. He said, Billy, it's been great working with you, and thank you for everything. I hope you and your wife have continue with your son Adam in Malaysia, because we moved.
Right.
And I said, sir, I just have to tell you, I can't thank you enough. So I need to put on the record. I have to tell you from the bottom of my heart, it means the world to me that you trusted me so implicitly. And he literally looked at me like I had three heads and said, well, of course I trusted you. He said, I never worried about you. He said, in this job, you can't do anything if you don't trust people. The reality is we've been burnt from time to time, but I want you to know not once did I ever think it was you. And that meant the world to me.
Yeah. It was interesting to think too about just his respect for the office and how you play. You were part of that too, right? He had this respect for the position of prime minister. And part of that was allowing himself to be documented at good times and bad for the glorious moments, the Mandela visit and so on, which you were there for, and also some of the tougher times.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I used to, I was very conscious of the fact that I wasn't being asked to leave room. I can tell you there was many times where he looked like death warmed over because of the stress and the strain and the hours that we were working. And he'd kind of look at me out of the corner of his eye. And the look was sort of like, I hope you're as tired as I am. But he never, ever asked me to not take that photo. And so if you actually went through National Archives and then looked at categories of stuff, you would see during different things a very, very tired and exhausted man. That's for sure.
And you also got to capture some remarkable moments. Everyone, I think people often think of the photography around a world leader as being very formal. But looking through all your photos, there's a lot of really wonderful informal moments. There's one where you take a picture of George W. Bush taking a picture of the Mulroneys. There's another great one of Nancy Reagan laughing. There's the one where the prime minister gives Margaret Thatcher a Canadian's jersey for her grandson. I mean, there's just some really great candid moments. And I think that really, in some ways, it really lifted Brian Mulroney as a person off the page.
You're absolutely right. And I guess being the fly on the wall and always being present, I got the very rare privilege of seeing these world leaders relax and have fun together. And when he gave Mrs. Thatcher that hockey jersey, I have to tell you, he was like a little kid. He was thrilled. He was so excited to surprise his friend Margaret with a Montreal Canadiens hockey jersey for her grandson, who was a Habs fan. And that day, I'd seen him very happy many times, but that day it was just like a little kid. And it was wonderful. And she was the same way. And with the Bushes, with all of them, you saw their very personal moments where basically, my observation was, we're all very much the same. These people have different jobs where they have to be careful how they look in public, what they say. Some people think Mr. Mulroney was very uptight about his dress. Well, if he was, he just never wanted to embarrass Canada. It's just that simple. You know, getting off an airplane, you want to look your best. And he was such a proud Canadian. It was just his pride of Canada.
Bill McCarthy was Brian Mulroney's official photographer for 5 years. He's taken some incredible shots, was there for some just pivotal moments in Canadian history and world history. He's been invited back by the family this week to take more photographs of this week as the Prime Minister lies in state and ahead of his state funeral coming up on Saturday. Bill, you mentioned it off the top. I mean, you've managed to maintain this relationship with the Mulroney family over many, many years, and you've talked about just how important family was to Brian Mulroney and how you thought of them as Brian and Mila, not just as Brian.
Well, everybody else would say Brian and Mila. Yours truly would never say that. For me, it's always been Mr. and Mrs.
Indeed.
No matter how many times Mrs. would say, "You can, Billy, you can call me Mila." No, I can't. You've never met my mother. And that's just simply total respect. I was always with him. I used to take great joy when there'd be a very serious meeting at 24 Sexton going on in the study, and it could be a world leader, it could be a provincial premier, serious stuff happens in the den. It's not just on Parliament Hill. And the door would open and one of the kids would walk through the door and everything stopped, the world stopped. And everybody present understood this. It's a man with his child. And usually it was Nicholas, and he'd come in and give his dad a hug and, he'd say good morning and stuff, and then his dad would send him on his way to have breakfast or maybe off to school. But everybody respected it because they all had family. And it was just one of those things that grounded everybody. And it was just a really wonderful thing to share.
Yeah. And you have a favorite photo that's also a Mr. and Mrs. Mulroney. I'll follow your lead, the Mr. and Mrs. Mulroney photo as well.
Well, I don't want to be too long, but it was during a bomb scare at the Commonwealth Conference in Vancouver in 1987. Mounties came into a ballroom and said, we need to evacuate right now. All the Commonwealth leaders were there, and it was very serious. And we left the room very quickly and through different doors because there's like 100 leaders. And I'm walking through a hallway with Rajiv Gandhi behind me and Margaret Thatcher in front of me. And it's like, oh my God, this is it. But we went into our holding room and the boss was just really disturbed. And Mrs. walked over to him and grabbed his earlobe and very affectionately said, Brian, calm down. It's okay. Everything's okay. And he wasn't angry. The interesting thing was he wasn't angry. He was terribly worried that Canada would be embarrassed. But the moment she touched his earlobe, he totally focused on her. And they connected. And she always made him focus, as did any of his kids that were present wherever we were. When they walked into a room, he totally focused on them. And that earlobe thing was early in my time. And I treasure that photo. It's in my bedroom and always has been, because it really signifies enduring love. And, I'm lucky. I've been married 40 years now, and that's the way we feel.
He also, I remember, and we can get to this because there's an interesting connection here. When you leave, I believe it's because your wife gets a position in Malaysia, so you leave and you have a very young child at the time. I think he asks you how the baby's doing. And Adam at this point is just young.
Well, Adam was 2 months old when there was so it's not when we were leaving. However, when Adam was 2 months old, there was the budget leak. Doug Small of Global News got a piece of the budget, and it was a huge deal. And so I ran up to the office because I was called, and there's ministers. It's a crisis. It's a budget leak. I don't know if it ever happened before. And I'm standing in this room, and the finance minister's coming through, and the clerk of the Privy Council, all these different people, crisis management. And at some point, the room is empty. And he's by himself, and he's kind of pacing a little bit. And then he notices I'm standing in the corner. He said, "Oh, Billy, you're still here." And I said, "Yes, sir. He said, "Why are you still here?" And I said, "Because it's my job." He said, "Oh, yeah, right." And then he says, "How's the baby?" He said, "Pardon?" He said, "How's the baby?" I said, "Sir, the baby's fine, but I just can't believe you're asking me this question." And he said, "Billy, I'm going to tell you something right now, and you listen up. There's nothing more important than that baby and your family. So what's happening here tonight is very important. And everybody's just left the room to help me crisis manage. You keep in mind, nothing's more important than your family. Because when we leave here tonight, you're going to go home to Anna Maria and Adam. And I'm going to go home to 21st Sussex. And I can guarantee you, whether it's midnight or 2 a.m., Mila's going to be standing on the front doorsteps of 21st Sussex to tell me I did a good job today. And probably because Caroline's older, she'd probably be there too. So, I mean, I wear that with pride that he actually said that to me, but I still can't get over the fact that he turned to me and said, how's the baby, with all stuff happening.
And remarkably, of course, Adam, that baby went on to become Prime Minister Trudeau's official photographer. A final thought then, now that you're there, you're sort of witnessing this week as we bid farewell to Brian Mulroney and all the stories I've heard over the last while and all the memories people have. What's your fondest memory then of all that, of that time?
Well, I guess it's the whole family, to be honest. It's there's that whole teamwork thing. We were an amazing group of people, I think, working around the family. We had great fun in the staff van and playing practical jokes on each other. My enduring memory of my time will be the love that was shared within that family, and I was part of it. And to give you an example, minutes ago, Ben walked up to me and gave me a hug and looked at Adam editing my photos in the corner and said, how often do you guys work together? And I said, almost never, never. So he's like, can I get your picture together? But I teared up. And he gave me a hug because he knew I was going to start to cry, because it means something.
It does. It does. Bill, congratulations on this, on being able to take part in this this week. And thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your kindness. I appreciate it.
In the U.S. today, the U.S. Justice Department and 16 state attorneys general have filed an antitrust lawsuit against Apple. They want to take a big bite out of the giant. The case is taking direct aim at the digital fortress that Apple has built around the iPhone and other products, so its hardware and software work seamlessly together. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland says Apple's strict restrictions against third-party technology forces consumers and developers to only use items under Apple's umbrella.
Apple creates barriers that make it extremely difficult and expensive for both users and developers to venture outside the Apple ecosystem.
If you own any Apple products, you know that, right? It's part of the appeal, by the way. Apple's defended what it's dubbed its walled garden as an indispensable feature prized by its customers who want the best protection available for their personal information. They also said in a statement that they disagree with the premise of the lawsuit and they would defend against it. The lawsuit also claims Apple's anti-competitive practices extend beyond the iPhone and Apple Watch businesses, citing advertising, browser, FaceTime, news offerings, et cetera, et cetera. And the government has not ruled out breaking up one of the largest companies in the world, the Justice Department official saying today on a briefing call that structural relief was on the table if the U.S. were to win this lawsuit. Carmi Levy is a tech analyst and journalist. He's been with us before. Carmi, welcome back. Thank you so much.
Good to be back, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Well, this feels like a big move. I mean, it's getting quite a bit of play in the tech press, obviously in the U.S. press, but this strikes me as being a pretty significant day.
It really is. It's hard to underscore just how significant this is. This is, the Department of Justice, the very definition of a big government agency, taking on the very biggest of the big tech companies. And so it's big government versus big tech, the showdown. And this comes after years of governments, both in the U.S. as well as in Europe and elsewhere, increasingly looking at the business practices, not just of Apple, but of other companies in that sort of rarefied stratosphere like Google and Amazon and Microsoft, and sort of questioning, is this a good thing? Is the way they operate good for consumers, good for the markets that they have created and that they continue to serve? Or are we kind of in the same position that we were a couple generations ago with telecommunications, or even further back with energy? And we have precedent in history of the DOJ taking on the major oil companies, the major telecom companies. They broke up the telecom companies. So there's a lot of legacy here where the government watches a market for a very long time. And then it either decides or doesn't decide whether it needs to do something about it. And clearly in technology, they've decided to do something about it. And it comes at a time when similar actions aren't happening, not just in the U.S., but European Union. We're 2 weeks removed from them fining Apple $2 billion in an antitrust case over streaming. So it's not just the DOJ kind of echoing history. It's other countries as well. It's this global effort now where governments are saying, technology companies, you've gotten a little bit too powerful. Time to knock you down a notch or two.
Yeah, I was interested in reading sort of the wording of the lawsuit. It says each step in Apple's course of conduct built and reinforced the moat around its smartphone monopoly. I mean, that's what the Department of Justice is claiming here. What's interesting is that if you own any Apple products, you're keenly aware of just how much you get trapped in their ecosystem.
Yeah, and you know, to a certain extent, you know, ecosystem isn't a bad word. You know, the reason many of us buy Apple product is because of that ecosystem, because of that moat. You know, would, for example, services like FaceTime or iMessage work as well if Apple didn't so vigorously work to create that environment, that landscape that is specific to its technology, if it didn't work to so tightly integrate its hardware and its software and its services and its apps and all the other things that make Apple, Apple. When you buy an iPhone, you're not just buying a physical piece of hardware. You're buying all that other intangible stuff that sort of makes it come alive. And that is ecosystem. That is walled garden. That is moat. And to a certain extent, there's value in that. It just works, is what a lot of people say. They don't have to be engineers. It just delivers the services that they want. The problem is, you know, Apple says, we're just innovating. This is the way we innovate, and we're going to fight this. But, you know, if you're on the other side of the equation, you see that innovation as a block to your ability to do business. Google sees Apple's innovation as a swipe across its messaging, that if you have an Android device, all of your messages on iPhone show up as green. You don't have access to all the cool features, no encryption, low res video, all of these things. And so the question then becomes, what does Apple owe the Googles of the world? What does Apple owe competing companies that aren't part of that ecosystem but want to be? And that really is the crux of this, is one person's antitrust is another person's competitiveness. And everyone's got a different definition. And it's cases like this that help lock down precisely where those lines need to be and sort of where that fairness is and what happens when we decide to cross it.
Right. And that is indeed Apple's counterargument here.
That's exactly it. Apple is saying, hey, you know, we're an innovative company. We came into a smartphone market that had no ecosystem. Remember, the iPhone was released in 2007, came to Canada a year later. And before that, smartphones were just a disaster of a category for 15 years or so. Manufacturers had been throwing different ideas at the wall, and none of them stuck because they were all expensive and ponderous, and developers couldn't get on board. There was no such thing as apps. Think of how the world has changed since the iPhone kind of forced the world's hand. And then, of course, Android followed along. But really, it was Apple that broke that logjam. So I don't want to give them more credit than they fully deserve. But I think we need to also recognize that what Apple created in that process and where they dragged the industry is exactly what the DOJ is arguing against today. And so, you know, we sort of have to separate creating an ecosystem that builds an economy that didn't previously exist and creates value for users and allows developers to create a career around it. And so we need to separate that, which I think we all agree is a value add. We all benefit from it, from some of the behaviors that Apple has engaged in that process, where they have blocked competitors from making their apps available. They have banned, for example, Fortnite was banned when they dared to introduce their own payment structure within Apple's App Store. And so then we ask ourselves the question, are the rules that Apple is implementing in creating this ecosystem, are they damaging, are they causing more damage than they are adding value? And that's also one of the questions that this case is supposed to answer, because right now we've just been asking those questions, but we haven't really been discussing them in earnest.
Right. I mean, if we fast forward a bit, you know, presumably this goes through and succeeds. I mean, the consequences could be pretty drastic. But what was interesting about the argument, too, is just one, it was about trying to bring down consumer costs, because I guess what Apple is now able to control is not just their ecosystem. They also can determine how much you're going to pay to get into it. And it was interesting to hear Merrick Garland talk about that what they're also trying to prevent here is Apple from getting any bigger. I mean, that was one of the things that came out loud and clear today, that they figure that Apple's just going to strengthen this monopoly, as they call it, if they're not stopped now.
Sure. And there's certainly a risk there that if the leading tech company becomes too big, where, you know, does that consume all the oxygen in the room so that another company might not emerge from the shadows? And that's always been, you know, when you sort of look through history at why governments decide to take on companies of this size and scope, it always seems to come down to that, is that have we left enough room for real competition, or are we just paying lip service to it? And what happens to the broader economy? What happens not only to this sector, but other sectors, especially because of the way these technologies tend to they infuse themselves across the broader economy? Does that damage the broader economy? Is it something that government needs to sort of put a check and balance on? And do we want to limit Apple's ability to grow? I mean, at one point it was dancing with a $3 trillion valuation. Is that ultimately good for consumers? Yes, we can always choose to buy a Google device instead of an Apple device. No one's forcing us to buy into Apple's ecosystem. But what happens if Apple remains as dominant as it is 5-10 years from now? Will companies like Google even continue to be able to compete, or will other organizations be able to emerge from the shadows, or will consumers at some point have even less choice than they have now? That's a reasonable question for governments to ask as well, and you would expect them to be asking it. You would expect them to be challenging industry norms to make sure that consumer interests aren't left behind in the rush for investors to get their dividends and get their profits from a successful company like Apple.
Yeah. Any concept or any idea how this might impact Canadian consumers? I mean, it's early days. Yeah, they've just announced it. But ultimately, how might this impact consumers here on this side of the border?
It's interesting because, this is ostensibly it's an American sourced action. It takes place in the U.S. It really shouldn't affect us here. But it always does, because Apple is a global company, and the American lawsuit really does deal with technologies that we all use here in Canada. And in fact, they are dominant here in Canada. So it is inevitable that if the outcome of this action does cause Apple to change direction, shift the way it creates technology, deploys it, manages it, markets it, all that stuff, that it will wash over the border, and the iPhone that you and I use and the services that run on it and run a good chunk of our economy are probably going to change. And that it'll be for good or not so good, depending on what side of the ledger you're on. But Canada will be affected by this. And that's even before the Canadian government weighs in. We know that the Competition Bureau has been looking at it, but we haven't seen anything concrete in that regard. But I'm guessing there's a little bit more push for them to act now that the U.S. has done so, now that the European Union has done so.
It will have a market value of $6.4 billion. Meanwhile, when you compare it to another, like the tech giant Meta Platforms, that's market value is $1.2 trillion. So it's much smaller, but it's something that we're talking about so much because we see so many users on this platform every day.
Yeah, she's talking about Reddit, which became a publicly traded company today, making it the first major U.S. tech firm, let alone social media platform, to do so in years. It ended its first day of trading in New York up 48%, which is pretty incredible. Investors valued the popular discussion forum site at nearly $9 billion when U.S. trading opened, well above the company's target valuation of $6.4 billion. So a big day for Reddit. Carmi Levy is with us this half hour, tech analyst and journalist. Carmi, I mean, I've used Reddit over the years. It's a pretty fascinating spot. I don't understand why I'd never quite thought of it in the same vein as many other social media platforms over the years.
Yeah, it's almost like the social media platform that is beloved by those people who know it, who get it, who use it, but really kind of ignored by everyone else. It started a little bit after Facebook, about 18 months after Facebook was launched, so back to 2005, but arguably both companies have taken a very different trajectory since then. It's almost like a company that has failed to launch. Below the radar, those who use it absolutely love it. It's almost like the town square of the internet. It's where you go. And I discovered it originally just from Google searching, where I was looking for answers for questions, and Reddit kept popping up. And then I realized, those subreddits are real treasure troves of insight of just regular people, regular users coached by the online moderators who volunteer their time to run these digital forums, these digital places, and they leave gold behind. You get an answer to every question you have on any subject you can imagine. This is the place. It's the community. It's the forum of yore that kind of existed before the internet and before social media sort of wiped them away. So there's certainly value there, but it's certainly not something that's been as widely recognized as a platform like Facebook or even Snapchat. And so, it going public, I remember as I was discussing it in the lead up, with friends and family members and colleagues, I would just get shrugs. They're like, I don't really understand the why. And you talk about it a little bit, people then realize it, but it takes a little bit of explanation. And we know that in the world of tech, you really shouldn't have to explain yourself. It should be immediately evident what that value proposition is.
Yeah, I was interested, though, there were some stats out today and for December of 2023. Google and YouTube by far are the most visited sites in Canada by a wide margin. But Reddit was fourth. So Facebook, 434 million. Reddit, 376 million. For comparison, Twitter was only 173 million. So Reddit, extremely popular with its very loyal fan base. But I was, and you pointed this out in a note you sent me earlier, they've never turned a profit, ever.
No. Imagine not making money for 19 years. Like at some point, you know, something's got to change. And I think that's why we find ourselves at the point of today's IPO, is that they simply couldn't continue as they had indefinitely. At some point, they needed to, you know, take all of that great goodwill and that wonderful engagement and those incredible metrics, because they are. It's a question of quality above quantity, but boy, what quality they have. And you know, people who love Reddit really love it. And you can't buy that in this day and age, especially looking at where other social media platforms have gone. You know, I think if you look at the average Facebook or X feed, it's pretty clear that they're clogged with a lot of things that really aren't value added. And a lot of us aren't spending as much time on them as we used to, whereas with Reddit, it's going the other way. There's a lot of value in that information, and it's certainly there's you know, the artificial intelligence industry has recognized that they can then use that data to train their large language models, train their next generation tools on not just random data from the internet, but really focused data from a really well structured source. And so there are lots of reasons why Reddit going forward could be a really good business for an investor. And AI certainly is at the middle. It's what they staked the entire IPO around. And it'll be interesting to see if they can sustain that beyond this first day pop. We often see companies have a really great first day result, but then long term, you know, are they able to turn that into a sustainable business? We're going to watch and wait and see what plays out here.
Yeah, I guess it's mostly advertising for Reddit at this point. Can you monetize it without destroying it? That's always the billion-dollar question.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at how other social media companies have sort of moved past what I like to call their early kumbaya phase, where everyone is so enthralled with them and they work wonderfully and there's nothing wrong with them at all, until they kind of realize, oh, we've got to monetize all of these users. And then before you know it, you're festooned with ads and you're almost overwhelmed by the algorithms. And that experience changes, it gets diluted. We've seen it happen with pretty much every other major platform. And I think that's the risk here, is that how can Reddit keep what made it special, but still find a way to make money off of what made it special? And that has, in all honesty, never been done in the social media era. There's no social media platform that has emerged from an IPO at a higher quality level than it was beforehand. That monetization process often kills the goose that laid the golden egg. And so it'll be interesting to see if Reddit maybe has some magic formula to avoid that fate. But again, I look to history, and it's hard to argue with history.
Yeah, but it did show that there's still interest out there in sort of social media and tech IPOs. It had been a long time.
Yeah, it had been. I mean, you know, this is their second kick at the can. They tried this about 2.5 years ago, and it was ultimately scuttled because it was stomped by the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and so investors lost interest. They lost momentum, essentially shelved it until they could try it again. And there's been this sort of valley of tech IPOs in that period, largely through the pandemic, and there have been a lot of companies that are sort of watching and waiting and seeing. So, for example, the payment company Stripe, or Noom, that does that, you know, sort of diet and wellness stuff, and Turo, where you can, you know, rent, drive other people's cars. Right. But, you know, no one's really sort of stepped forward. And I think they were waiting for the marquee company to try it first. That's what this is. If it went well, other companies would then step in and end the drought. If it didn't go well, then I guess that drought will continue. So far, all indications look positive, and I would guess that will then open the floodgates somewhat toward other high valuation, you know, what we call special companies, taking a similar step in the months to come.
Yeah, I guess we'll see tomorrow how well Reddit does on day two. Carmi, as always, thank you.
Appreciate being here, Ben. Thanks.
Last night on the show, we spoke with UBC's John Helliwell, who spent more than a decade helping put together something known as the World Happiness Report. It got a ton of coverage right around the world. And here's why. First of all, countries like to know where they sit, right? This is how it works. People in 143 countries and territories are asked to evaluate their life on a scale from 0 to 10, with 10 representing the best. Results from the past 3 years are then averaged to create a ranking. So it's not just a one-year thing. It is a bit of an average over time. Canada has slipped in 2024. So our three-year average is now down. We're in 15th place, which is not bad at all if you consider Finland is still number one. It has been for 7 years. We were down a couple of spots. And the reason for that, and this was the big story that emerged from this report yesterday, is that under 30s in this country, in America, in Japan, in a couple other places, Western countries mainly, are not happy. If you just take that group, Canada ranks all the way down at 58th. Can you imagine 58th? Part of the reason why is the over 60s have Canada in 8th place. And the over 60s in America have them in 10th place, whereas under 30s in America are down even lower at 62nd, which helped push the U.S. out of the overall top 20 for the very first time. Here is what John Helliwell, editor of the report, had to say about that finding on the show last night.
It is the biggest change we've noticed is the decline in the last 12 years of the self-assessed life quality of those people under 30. And it isn't just the world, obviously, because it isn't happening in the rest of the world. It's quite specific to those countries indeed.
Right, John Helliwell. You can listen to that whole interview. It's fascinating on our podcast. You can find that at littlemoreconversation.com or anywhere where you find your favorite podcast. We put all our interviews there each and every night. So if you miss one or you want to share one or you want to listen to one again, that's the best place to find them. In most countries, life satisfaction, of course, typically begins to drop from childhood through adolescence and into adulthood. And you tend to get a little bit happier when you retire. Overall, worldwide, 15 to 24s are still reporting greater life satisfaction than older adults, but the happiness gap is narrowing in Western Europe, and it's been reversed in North America due to the falling satisfaction among the young under the age of 30. So why this huge gap? There's been a lot of speculation. Felix Chung is with the University of Toronto. He spoke yesterday, said this is a structural problem.
When one person is unhappy, that's an individual problem. But when the entire population is unhappy, in this case, when the entire youth population is unhappy, is now no longer an individual problem, but rather a structural problem. And a structural problem requires structural solutions.
The Happiness Report's findings came as no surprise to my next guest. He's been sounding the alarm about generational inequality in this country for more than a decade now. Paul Kershaw is a professor at UBC's School of Population and Public Health. He's founder of Generation Squeeze, which is Canada's leading voice for generational fairness. You can listen to his Hard Truths podcast as well. And Paul Kershaw joins me now. Paul, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
I certainly thought of you the moment I saw these stats yesterday, just this incredible disparity between the generations now in this country, in the US, Japan, elsewhere in Western Europe as well, this happiness gap that's so pronounced between the under 30s and the over 60s. What was your reaction to seeing those numbers?
Well, it's entirely in line with the Gen Squeeze findings that we've been sharing for well over a decade. And this divide in happiness is yet another reflection that hard work isn't paying off for a younger demographic today in Canada as it did for previous generations. And since hard work paid off relatively well, especially for boomers, to some degree, I'm an Xer, you know, those older demographics are reporting a kind of security. And that's not surprising because they managed to access housing at a time that it was in reach for what hard work could earn. And then that housing has gone up in value and given them not only security, but wealth. But by contrast, their kids and grandchildren are working just as hard, actually getting more education than ever, starting with more post-secondary debt. But the jobs that they're landing, they pay all right, but nothing near what putting shelter over your head really requires any longer. And that creates a level of stress. That creates a level of anxiety that, am I doing something wrong? And so people start to internalize it, that they might be at fault. And then we are at risk of people not seeing that there's something systemic going on in our economy and in our public policy responses that is, you know, allowing their hard work to not pay off. And then sometimes we belittle them, saying, it's your avocado toast eating and your latte drinking and your cell phone holding. And those are the reasons, those are the individual decisions you're making that are accountable for your financial precarity. All those factors then give rise to a level of anxiety and unhappiness. And happiness isn't just driven by money. We don't need to, I think that the report is clear on that. But happiness sometimes is a relative comparison.
They call it the happiness report, but it's really sort of an optimism report. It's about, you know, what do you feel? It seems to me it's how optimistic are you about the future, right? I mean, it is about now, but it certainly, I felt like that was what was jumping out from these numbers.
Yeah. And they point to 2010 as being a really significant year for things changing in Canada and other westernized countries. And the dream that a good home would be in reach for what hard work can earn, either as an owner or potentially a renter or some other form of tenure, that dream has been getting more and more out of reach. And that is a huge milestone for success, for adulthood. And those things matter for one's sense of optimism, to use your language, and that will then filter into a sense of happiness. And so we have really been locking out younger generations from that. And then our solution has been, well, we'll rely on the banks of mom and dad or grandma and grandpa. And that is a hit and miss solution that has a number of implications. One, if that's our solution, you continue to infantilize young adults, right? Like, oh, you can't make it on your own without help from your parents. Like, that is not going to be something that's going to make an adult feel good about themselves. Second of all, you can't know how many conversations I have with people. It's like, well, my parents were that keen early on in helping, you know, tapping into their growing housing equity to help us. They're like, just work harder. And that then reinforced that, again, it's an individual responsibility rather than a broken intergenerational system. I would argue at the root of such anxiety and stress amongst younger Canadians is an extraction of so much housing wealth out of our housing markets, myself included. Full disclosure, my home's up $1.5 million. I'm almost age 50. So people like me and older than me, we've been extracting a lot of wealth out of the housing system. That's been good for us. But the consequence is those just as smart of us, just as hardworking as us, but younger than us or newcomers of any age, they can't now live where we are. They can't afford where we are. And that is going to be a big pressure point on happiness. And then we should probably then broaden it out to like, and there are some frightening things happening in the world too, which we can get to.
Yeah. What was also interesting here, and you pointed out on the Generation Squeeze website, is that this isn't, it is about housing and affordability. And we know what a struggle that's been over the past little while. But the system too itself, I mean, I don't know, want to talk about the system in such a broad way, but I think people under 30 recognize that it seems like the deck is a bit stacked against them. And that goes right down into government policy and so on and so on and so forth.
Oh, wow. Thank you for just like lobbing it up there for me to like just hit on something so important. And I love your metaphor. It is absolutely the case that younger generations have been given a bad generational deal. The deck has been stacked against them. This theme of extraction doesn't just play out in housing, where we've extracted so much of the wealth, we leave little affordability left over. In terms of climate change, we've extracted so much of the atmosphere's ability to absorb carbon that we now have left extreme weather as the legacy. And then think about tax dollars. Anyone who listens to Jen Squeeze and our very evidence-based analysis of how tax dollars are being used, we're extracting so much with our tax dollars to invest later in the life course for our aging family members, the boomers in our lives now increasingly, who we love and adore and want to protect. But we leave little left over to invest in the needs of a younger generation. Investments in childcare, in housing, in poverty reduction for younger people are much smaller than for an older demographic. And we're leaving them large government debts. That's like the public way in which we add pressure to the private vice grip in which people are finding that they're going to school more, start with student debt more often, land jobs that are actually paying thousands less if you adjust for inflation compared to when boomers started, and then being hammered in the housing market. That is just a lousy generational deal.
And when you look at one of the other interesting phenomenon here is if you look at how this is translating into other areas such as politics, I heard someone saying today, if you told someone 5 years ago that most people under the age of 30 would be thinking of voting the government out because they didn't like what was going on. I mean, it has wide reaching impacts for all of us, presuming they mobilize.
Oh, absolutely. The generational divide is shaping Canadian politics right now. And so one of the things that's driving Mr. Poilievre's rise in the polls is that coinciding with hard work not paying off for younger generations, those generally like, well, then I'm frustrated with who's in power now. And that's actually nonpartisan frustration. So in BC, that could be like a frustration potentially, you know, with the NDP. in Ontario with the Ford Conservatives, federally with the Liberal, the Trudeau Liberals. And there I just show my nonpartisanship. But they're just like, the status quo isn't working. And so if you're in opposition right now, you can attract that frustration. I get worried when people attract it in a way where they're farming the rage, but not actually offering solutions, because just acknowledging people's grief and attracting them with anger, it's a good political strategy, but we need actually more than that. We do need solutions. And so I'm looking for our opposition parties to play politics well, but also play policy well. I'm here in Ottawa right now. I have been trying to brief the federal Liberals in advance of the next budget. And I'm hearing more and more politicians talk in the language of there is a generational divide, and we need to enshrine generational fairness into the machinery of government so that this tension that's evolved over the last many decades, it's not just the current government. This has been a process over decades. And had we had generational fairness sort of built into the machinery of government, so we're like, what's going on for young and old? Like, are we getting this right? We could have nipped it in the bud. We didn't. But if we enshrine it now, at least we can, you know, get better at fixing it now and then say never again, because we don't want to leave either the aging loved ones in our families behind or their kids and grandchildren behind. And yet we are absolutely crushing the dreams, hopes, and aspirations of many a younger person. And you can then pick it up in this report where their happiness levels, like if you were just ranking Canada in terms of happiness for people under 30, we're 58th, if I recall the data.
Paul Kershaw is with us this half hour. He is the founder of Generation Squeeze, Canada's leading voice for generational fairness. We're talking about the unhappiness of people under 30 in this country, who ranked to put Canada in 58th place overall, with just 6 on 4 on 10 out of on the happiness index, which has pushed Canada down to 15th overall this year. Paul, I know this is a very broad question, but there are probably a few things we could focus on to try to at least start to address what seems to be a pretty, at least on the part of people under 30, an awareness and a belief that there is a generational issue going on here. Where do you begin? Is it just housing? I mean, we're seeing a lot around housing now. Is that where we start?
I think housing has been the epicenter of the harm that has been caused to younger people. And so, you know, having us as a country say, to restore affordability for all, we need home prices to stall so that earnings have half a chance to catch up. I think we've been growing a political consensus around that. When last we saw polling, 70% of Canadians agreed. I bet you it's higher now. And we have actually had the prime minister say as much, that, yeah, we want home prices to stall. And actually, happily, in 2023, they finally did after years. It's not like mission accomplished, but it is at least we've stopped the bleeding. And now how do we start to recalibrate and support a younger demographic more? We are going to have to ask, though, people like me, as I said earlier, I'm turning 50, and those older than me in particular, like, we have extracted a lot of wealth out of this. Like, it's been working for me. And so I'm increasingly looking to that older demographic. And say, how do we put our housing wealth to work? And not just for ourselves and even in our own family. How do we put it to work, you know, for public policy purposes to get us deeply affordable housing and or to spend on the things that an aging population needs, like more medical care, but leave some tax dollars left over to make sure that we invest in the $10 a day childcare, the poverty reduction for families with kids, that, and also to tackle, I think we should pivot here to climate change, because climate change is sort of is such an existential risk. And I must confess that it breaks my heart to hear even younger kids say they now don't look forward to summer because that's the smoky time. I think that is a huge part of the underlying angst and happiness that you're kind of picking up from a younger demographic right now, because there's the existential climate crisis, there are wars around the world, and then that's then coming down and yet another pressure on top of the wallets that are being squeezed so much by housing that's left their earnings behind.
I wonder that over time, I mean, politicians have always been keenly aware that older folks vote. They vote a lot and always have. It's just one of those things in this country. And therefore, that's who you tailor your policies towards in some ways. It would be, I imagine, at this point in time, when we see the kind of something like that happiness report, it would be imperative for young people to get out there and make their voices heard at the ballot box, where it can matter, where you can really put the squeeze, so to speak, to put the squeeze on the politicians to act in their best interests.
Yeah, or I would say to squeeze back on the politicians. And so you're so right. And this is one of the big challenges we now face, because I think part of the unhappiness that we're picking up for a younger demographic, is that it plays out in a kind of a cynicism that that politics and democracy isn't working really for a younger demographic. And rather than having that a younger demographic then lean in to say we're going to fix that, Jen Squeeze is finding it's hard to convince them, like, don't give up on democracy. We got to fix it because there are no there are really few individual ways in which you can work your way out of this. This vice grip on your wallet. Individually, hard work isn't paying off. We need to change policy to reward that hard work. And so policy comes from politics. And if there's a cynicism amongst a younger demographic, we then need to go to what I like to call grand ambassadors. We have to go to those that you identified as being more likely to show up. So that is our parents and grandparents, and saying, right now, we need you to not only vote for your healthy retirement, but to vote for a healthy retirement that doesn't come at the expense of the happiness of your kids and grandchildren, of the economic security of your kids and grandchildren, of the climate sustainability on which your kids and grandchildren depend. And so we really need our parents and grandparents to vote as grand ambassadors. Go and ask their kids and grandchildren, what would you want us to vote for? And then shape their vote accordingly.
Yeah, and I suppose because there's been lots of speculation about where this unhappiness number is coming from. And, it's not avocado toast and it's not too much time on Instagram.
I think we can say with certainty that that's not the source of the unhappiness. And, you should know, I have graduate students living 10 people to a small home to try and make a go of it, to get more education, to land a job that might be able to help them pay their rent. That was not the case very long ago for young folks. When you have to have grad students, you rely on food banks. That was not the norm. Like, we are really making it difficult for people to establish a financial foundation. Not that long ago, I wrote about how much of a game changer it is when people can access $10 a day childcare. And, the way in which people describe that is it was a lottery. It was like winning the lottery. It was just that big a deal. It was such a relief. And people were like, I could move out of a mouse infested moldy basement into something that was appropriate for my family. Or other people said it allowed me to think like I could afford to have a child. Like, those are life-changing experiences that public policy can bring in, but it shows you just how hard the economic vice grip has been in squeezing out the aspirations of a couple of generations of really devoted, hardworking, talented young people.
Paul, as always, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for the invitation. I'm so pleased you're featuring this theme on multiple interviews.
It's interesting. We were talking about Reddit before, which is, if you go onto Reddit, it's just a wealth of information. It feels like you have information at your fingertips just about everywhere these days. You know where that's not true? Government documents. There was an article in the Globe and Mail, I think last year, was called How Canada's Freedom of Information System Broke Under Its Own Weight. Information held by government is supposed to be yours or ours, yet at every turn, the process gives institutions incentives to keep records hidden. It's supposed to be a pretty simple process. I've done it. You file a Freedom of Information request, you outline what you want, and then within a relatively short period of time, you either get back a response saying it's not clear enough, or you get back the documents that you've asked for, maybe some redactions in there, which happens now and then. That's not happening anymore. In fact, it's gotten slow and onerous. Often what you get in return months, even years later, is heavily redacted. And oftentimes you have to pay through the teeth just to get it. So my next guest decided the best way to tackle the problem head on was to at least create a one-stop place for the available information and make it easier for others to access. Matt Malone is founder of Open by Default and an assistant professor of law at BC's Thompson Rivers University. And with the help of the Investigative Journalism Foundation, he's helped set up what's being billed as the largest database of internal government documents ever made accessible to the public. If you want to know how it works, an article that's proving pretty popular for Post Media papers today called Secret RCMP Report Warns Canadians May Revolt Once They Realize How Broke They Are. That's a pretty eye-catching headline. I guarantee you the report wasn't nearly so salacious. Well, that report was one of the documents that was included on that database that the reporter accessed and then turned it into a pretty meaty story. Matt Malone, assistant professor of law at Thompson Rivers University, joins me now. Matt, thanks so much for your time tonight.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Tell me about the inspiration for this, because I think you'd understand as a journalist, I've been foiled by FOI more than I want to talk about.
Absolutely. The state of journalism in Canada today is really appalling, and we need to do as much as possible to help journalists tell stories that we need to hear. It's as an average citizen, it's really sad to see the state of the information environment out there. But that's not how it was born. I mean, my project started with my own experiences doing research in trade secrets and confidential information law. And I was doing some research on, of all things, the ArriveCan app And I was using the access information system a lot. I filed dozens of requests back in the summer of back in 2022. And some of those requests are not even answered, which should give you a sense of how broken the system is. And that experience lit me up to some major problems. And I thought we had to address this by putting as much information as possible that's already in the public domain in a site that is available to everyone instantly.
Yeah, I mean, it was reminding me that this goes back a very long time, but in the day there was an FOI office for the federal government in Ottawa. And what you could do is you could go in and you'd be allowed, you'd look through other people's FOI requests. And if they had been approved, you too could have access to that information, even though you hadn't done the work, right? And this struck me. And now that was a bit, it wasn't underhanded. It was totally fair. But that is a bit of what this is. You're taking what's available out there and making it available.
So the government has made a digital room that mirrors the one you're talking about, which is called open.canada.ca. But apart from the name, that website's not very open. You can go on, and what they will do is give you summaries of access to information requests that have been made and answered. But apart from the summary, they don't give you access to the underlying record. You have to access it through what's called an informal request. Mm-hmm. And everyone who makes those informal requests individually, it just adds to the strain on the system. So the government has chosen, rather than putting the records in the public domain, to create this additional procedural barrier, which actually slows down access to information. So what we did is we started collecting from donors and from other sources a bunch of these copies of access to information requests, and we compiled them in a single repository on the openbydefault.ca website. And we've done some really cool things with it.
It's a great idea, by the way, because it was, you're right. What's been interesting to watch within government is that, of course, part of the problem here, not to only lay the blame on government itself, or all governments, by the way, this is certainly not Ottawa, this is provincial too, is that there's just, in the digital age, there is so much more stuff. There's so much more documentation that the entire system is basically not fit for purpose anymore in any real way.
I absolutely agree. And we need to drag it into the 21st century. I mean, the underlying legislation here at the federal level hasn't been updated since the early 80s. And many of the procedures are, you know, they're not only Byzantine, but they're antiquated. So what we tried to do, and what we're doing with this project, is using technology to really solve this problem. So one of the things we've done is created a bunch of automation tools. The IJF, the Investigative Journalism Foundation, has a bunch of computer scientists who have helped create these automation tools that essentially crawl the internet to collect these requests and get these copies. And then we've had some very high power users of the access to information system, some incredible individuals, legendary individuals in Canadian journalism, actually, who have very selflessly come forward and said, we like this idea. We're so happy that someone's doing this, and you can have all of my records. You know, I'm a retired journalist. I've filed thousands and thousands. I wrote for the CBC or the Globe or whatever. And here you go. And so we're really excited to get that information online, and we'll be doing that in the coming months as well. So it's really just going to keep growing through these automation tools as well as the donors.
What is amazing about it, I mean, I think one important thing to keep in mind here is that ultimately, other than things that are clearly secret or confidential or personal information, they're meant to be in the public domain. This is our stuff, essentially.
Absolutely. And there's so many interesting uses that this information could go to. We've got regulatory data or testing data from Health Canada. And you just think of the innovations that could be unlocked by putting this information in the public domain and researchers accessing it and suddenly finding new uses of this information. So I'm excited about it mainly because I think it will help journalists. I think creating these barriers to journalists accessing information, you know, is one of the reasons why we have the information environment we have, where it's really difficult to get these really good stories. There are already enough pressures on journalists nowadays. But so that will help sort of address the trust deficit that we have in Canada with our institutions, and it will help journalists sort of increase accountability. But there's all these other public interests that I'm so excited about, like giving this information to innovators who might be able to create technologies based on having access to this information, or people who will, you know, like these sleuths who will kind of go in and look at old files and try to find stories. I mean, one user reached out to me to talk about looking at does a lot of research on cold cases, and that was very interesting. And other people have pulled things out and sent them to me, and I've been so fascinated to see the really unpredictable uses. But the folks that I'm most excited about our journalists, and it's been really touching to receive comments from journalists who've been so excited about it.
Matt Malone is with us this half hour. He's an assistant professor of law at Thompson Rivers University in BC. He's also founder of Open by Default, which is the largest database of internal government documents ever made accessible to the public. I've already had a look through it, of course, because most people in my position would, and there's lots of things in there. There's all kinds of documentation. Now, just to be fair, as you well know from looking through documents like this, not a lot of them are just a lot of info. You got to be really patient to dig through them, but you've already seen some of your work translate into media stories. In fact, there was a big one out today about this RCMP report.
Yeah, we've seen lots of stories come out. There's been stories about funding programs during the COVID-19 pandemic. I think a day after we launched, there was a fun story about some tweets that the Canada Revenue Agency had put out. And then we added a document recently about the RCMP warning about upcoming crises impacting policing efforts in Canada, a sort of secret report that was prepared. And that's gotten a little bit of volume in the media. So it's been really exciting to see journalists be using this to tell stories.
Yeah, where would you like to? I mean, I think there was one thing that was interesting about this too, is ultimately you'd also like to use this to point out the gaps in who's supposed to be doing this work, which is government, right? I mean, you want to point this out that in fact the government FOI system is broken in such a way that it means that a database like this needs to exist.
That's right. So there is an internal government brief that we actually obtained through Access to Information, which said that the government So the government said they couldn't do this and they would have to spend almost $1 billion. And the Globe covered this last year. But we actually built our prototype for $5,000. So there's really no excuse when it comes to cost. There are some issues when it comes to making government documents accessible, searchable. We worked with Document Cloud to do that. But fundamentally, we face some really serious challenges with misinformation, with disinformation, with an overabundance of information. And that's why we need good information and information that is true, information that comes from the government. The Access to Information system is such a lifeblood of our democracy. The sponsorship scandal, which kept government accountable, came from Access to Information. You know, there was an article today about the Department of National Defense conducting cyber operations against foreign adversaries under new expanded powers. This is all Access to Information. So some of the most important stories we're getting are coming from this. And we need to do more. I am hopeful we'll get a little bit more funding to keep the project growing and expand it to other jurisdictions, which I know we're just focusing on the federal government right now, but I'd like to get this to all the jurisdictions in Canada, all the provinces and the cities that don't make information open by default.
Yeah, it's ironic. We started off talking about how the inspiration for this was you trying to get information about ArriveCan, and here they are saying that to build a database that you built for about $5,000 would cost them $1 billion. So how did that work out, by the way? Did you ever get all the documentation you were looking for in ArriveCan? You're still waiting, I gather?
I'm still waiting on a few of them. So most of the requests I got was able to share, but I'm currently in the process of complaining with the Information Commissioner about a few requests, including a request pertaining to obtaining the source code for the app, which was withheld in its entirety under a redaction. So I've got, I think, 3 or 4 requests that are still pending. So they're over two years old now. So that tells you a lot about how slow the system is. There was one requester who put in a request for information related to an RCMP operation, and he got told you have to wait 80 years. Earlier this season, the Rodel report about, you know, war criminals in Canada, which was requested under Access to Information, took almost 40 years to come out. So we need to do a lot more. And I'm hopeful that this is just the start of some other projects that are related to Access to Information that we can tug on, so that we can build an infrastructure that helps journalists.
Yeah, and it's also good for people to see FOI or sort of these documents referred to in stories, because it reminds people that there is information in there worth seeing, and not to ignore the fact that it's been harder and harder to get. Matt, thank you so much. We'll be watching. I've already used it. It's a great database. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. It's my pleasure. And I just have to say, the best James Bond is George Lazenby. So I just wanted to set the record straight.
Oh, I see. There you go. I should have asked you because I was about to, but I had some time here. George Lazenby is a really interesting choice because he famously says in the movie, this never happened to the other guy. Right?
It's such a good movie. Honor Majesty's Secret Service. The Hidden Gem.
It is a fantastic movie. Thanks so much, Matt. Have a good night.
Your luck, Mr.
Bond. James Bond. When you carry a 00 number, it means you're licensed to kill, not get killed.
Welcome to Jamaica, Mr. Bond. News of my arrival leaked.
Who are you working for?
There you have it, the trailer to Dr. No from back in 1962. It has become the most successful franchise in movie history since Sean Connery first uttered those infamous words all the way back then, 62 years ago now, if my math is right. I would ask you about your favorite Bond tonight. Cat Gimley was nice to give me some background on George Lazenby. He was a TV model. He was in an ad for a candy bar called Fry's Chocolate Cream. The theme of the ad was Big Fry, and all the women were losing their minds over him, as we Brits have always pronounced it Lazenby. Yeah, that's, you know, it's funny. He was in that one movie. I think a lot of people agree that Honor Majesty's Secret Service was one of the best Bond films, even if Lazenby mightn't have been the most loved Bond. Of course, he had the great misfortune of trying to step into Sean Connery's shoes. And of course, Sean Connery came back soon after that. The best Bond, Sean Connery for some reasons, Roger Moore for different reasons, Daniel Craig for different reasons again. However, there can be no dispute that Timothy Dalton was by far the worst James Bond, followed very closely by Pierce Brosnan. That's what Frank in Surrey has to say. And hey, Ben, of Bond, my favorite is Daniel Craig. Some of the books, movies, jokes, situations, character names, etc., have not aged well, I would agree. Favorite Bond song? That's a good question because it has evolved over the years. But if I had to pick one, I'd have to say Live and Let Die by Paul McCartney. That was always my favorite one, followed closely by A View to a Kill by Duran Duran, because I'm of that age. Leo says Goldfinger, Shirley Bassey, of course, Diamonds Are Forever as well. Shirley Bassey, the Queen. I would agree, Leo. Goldfinger is another great one as well. So let's dive into some James Bond here. There have been 25 films over six decades, the last one being 2021's No Time to Die, which marked the swan song for Daniel Craig after 16 years as 007. The 56-year-old, spoke to talk show host Graham Norton about hanging up the Walter PPK and putting away those shaken martinis.
To have the opportunity to make these films has been, it's the biggest thing in my professional career, clearly, but one of the biggest things in my life. It's very emotional. I'm glad I'm sort of ending it on my own terms, which is really, I'm grateful to the producers for allowing me to do that. But I shall miss it. I mean, I'll probably be incredibly bitter when the new person takes over.
There you have it, incredibly bitter. Well, that time is drawing near, of course, because I think they're planning on starting to film the new one early next year. So we should be finding out really soon who will be the seventh official 007. And the Sun newspaper in the UK this week is reporting that the next one to take on the role will be 33-year-old British actor Aaron Taylor-Johnson. He may not be a familiar name to all. He certainly wasn't to me. I had to Google it when I read the article. He made his name playing a young John Lennon in 2009's Nowhere Boy. He was in Marvel's Avengers Age of Ultron, the two Kick-Ass movies, if you've seen those. And he won a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor for his role in the 2016 thriller Nocturnal Animals.
Information?
Yeah.
Let's exchange information.
Right. We'll get out of the glove compartments.
Okay, I'm a Gemini. My favorite color is petal pink. I like long walks and kittens.
Okay, now he doesn't sound British, but he is indeed British. He said recently, he told Numero magazine that he found it, quote, charming and wonderful that people see me in that role. And when asked about the rumors naming him as the next Bond, he said, I take it as a great compliment. So his lips are sealed. He's not exactly an A-lister, right? But certainly accomplished. And that fits the bill for a lot of Bonds, including, Timothy Dalton, as we walk away from the most recent one, whose name, Daniel Craig, was just about completely slipped me there. Daniel Craig, too. I mean, he made some really interesting, cool movies, but he wasn't a household name when he got the role. Other names that have been grist for the rumor mill of late include Henry Cavill of Superman and Richard Madden of The Bodyguard. I know you saw that. That was a really cool miniseries. James Norton of Happy Valley. Reggae Jean Page of Bridgerton. Hope I got his name right. Cillian Murphy even came up although he's just won an Oscar, so I highly doubt that. And fan favorite has been Idris Elba, of course, from Luther for a very long time now. But Elba came out and said, you know, he's already in his early 50s. He figures if he had to play the role for the 16 years, say, that Daniel Craig did, that it just wouldn't work. So he seems to have counted himself out. It's not official about Aaron Taylor-Johnson yet, but we wanted to get reaction to what looks like a move in that direction. Murray Gillespie knows everything there is to know about Bond. He's managing editor at James Bond Canada, and he joins me again. Murray, thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Nice to be back with you. How are you?
Good, good. This always feels like a big deal. I noticed that when The Sun broke this news in Britain a little earlier this week, there was a huge surge of interest in the next Bond. I guess this is always a very big reveal.
It always happens this way. I mean, it happened in 2006 when Daniel Craig took over the role. But most of the major media outlets, they just pick it up as media fodder. So if the BBC picks it up, the Mirror picks it up, the Sun picks it up, all of a sudden it's on NBC, Good Morning America. And it's just, you know, it's just a talking point. It's just something new, but it's like waiting every 4 years to announce where they're going to have the Olympics. People want a new Bond movie. They want to see where the franchise is going. There's a lot of changes within the franchise itself and the powers that be who are controlling the movies. And so, yeah, people are chomping at the bit and anxious for the next 007.
Indeed. And in this case, I gather Aaron Taylor-Johnson seems to be, I mean, we don't know this to be sure yet, but it seems to be the odds-on favorite. I don't even really know who Aaron Taylor-Johnson is, I confess.
I think most people, again, you know, there are some people who follow particular actors or series, you know, whether it be watching the rise of, you know, Timothy Chalamet from Call Me By Your Name to the Dune saga, etc. But I believe that most people would recognize Aaron Taylor-Johnson from the Marvel series where right. He played, I guess the character was Quicksilver, the brother to the Scarlet Witch, the Maximoff character.
Yes, and now I know it. Yes, now I know.
Yeah, the blonde hair, you know, the one who runs around fast and misses the bullet. Again, most of these actors, you know, we're looking at between 25 and 30 and usually British. You know, we've had two British Bonds, an Australian Bond, a Welsh Bond, an Irish Bond. I think we can safely say that the role will not go to an American.
Indeed. It's interesting, though, that while many of the early favorites, Idris Elba was obviously one of them, there were a lot of other sort of big name actors that were associated with the role, that oftentimes, and this was the case with Daniel Craig, probably the case with Timothy Dalton as well, they don't often go for the biggest name. They seem to go for the right fit for the franchise. And that's an interesting choice.
Well, I think that's kind of been a thread through the entire Bond series. Right. The actor who plays Bond is not just, an advertising billboard for the next product placement. He's an ambassador for cinema, for the franchise, for millions of dollars of product placement. And there's always been a this or that side to choosing a Bond. Do you choose a well-known actor who people will know and love and immediately adopt, or do you go in some of these vehicle movies or large movies where, you know, it's a blockbuster, $100-200 million, and they pick a no name? Like, look at the rise of, let's say, someone like Anya Taylor-Joy. Mm-hmm. Right, until we saw her in The Queen's Gambit, probably not a big a big presence, and now she's the darling of Hollywood. So other actors in that realm, probably like Luke Newton, who's also British, same age, people would know him from Bridgerton. Callum Turner, also a very good actor, just recently played the lead in the new George Clooney movie, The Boys in the Boat. Mm-hmm. So Aaron Taylor-Johnson is just, you know, the top card in the deck, and people are using that as a springboard and a launching point to see what happens. When I talked about the changes in the franchise, we know that Barbara Broccoli is still, you know, at the helm, but Michael Wilsing is getting on in years, and he has had some, minor health issues as one ages, obviously, as we all do. And so, that will be moving to his son, Greg, and as more of a co-executive producer. And that might bring a new edge, a new perspective to Bond, because the one thing people are wondering about the franchise in the next movie beyond who's playing him is, okay, Bond's dead.
Yeah.
Spectre's dead. MI6 is dead. What are they going to do? Are they going to turn it into a sort of 60s reboot a la Henry Cavill in Argyle? Like, is it going to be a Bond movie meets a Guy Ritchie period piece like Kingsman? So if you are going to get a young actor like that, you have to have someone that's suave, debonair, who looks the Bond and who's going to grow into that part. Someone who's going to be believable as a 60s British spy, not a modern day 21st century spy.
Right. No Time to Die. You're right. Everyone died in No Time to Die.
It's Gave to God. I mean, literally, we walked out. We're like, okay,
oh, that's so it.
Everyone's dead. That's it. It's done.
Take me a bit behind the scenes about how these decisions are made, because I know it's come out over time, sort of how Timothy Dalton was selected, how Pierce Brosnan was finally brought in, how Daniel Craig was selected. It's a really interesting process. There is history here.
Absolutely. And I think it just goes back to the decisions of the producers and Eon Productions and what they're looking for. I mean, we all know that, you know, by the time Roger Moore did his last movie, I mean, he was pretty long in the tooth.
Yeah,
it was. Yet,
A View to a Kill is a pretty
long. Oh, my God. Tough, that scene tough watch. With Grace Jones is one of the most cringeworthy moments ever to watch.
It is.
And so they need someone who's young enough to do 4 or 5 movies. This isn't the 60s where they could churn out 5 movies in 5 years. So they have to be aware of that. And yet you have to have enough sort of star power to make it interesting. But as soon as you do that, you talk about Idris Elba. Will people see that as typecast? I mean, look at what happened to Pierce Brosnan with Remington Steele, right? People knew him. They loved him. They said he'd make a great Bond. The producers agreed, right? They offered him the role. As soon as NBC got wind of his popularity, one day before the series was to be let go, they picked up the option. Back, he went to Remington Steele under contract. Timothy Dalton got the role. 9 episodes in, they canceled Remington Steele. So it is, again, a complete decision of the producers to decide whether they want to literally start fresh. Start with a good actor. I mean, a quality script and a good actor, someone who's got some chops and some teeth, to make the role believable. And if the actor is good, the script is good, the director is good, the film is going to come out exactly the way they want it. If they go with a more seasoned actor, someone who's known, I know him from that, how far does that stereotype go? And now, as an actor in their 30s or 40s, they realize that they're now locked in for 10 or 12 years. What actor wants that? I mean, we always hear about that all actors want is to work, and they want variety. They want roles with depth, comedy, action. So to expand their career, if you're looking at an actor who's, you know, done a few things and is ready to move on to something juicy and wants to grab that Bond role and carry it for 10 years, that's their gig. That's their only gig. That is the part of the contract that if you're Bond, you are nobody else, because we can't have you in other movies. And that wasn't so much the case, you know, in the 60s when, you know, Sean Connery did Marnie and other things like that. You can't have anyone be Bond except Bond, and that's it.
Murray Gillespie is managing editor at James Bond Canada. We're talking about the next James Bond. Speculation is heating up because apparently they're supposed to start shooting the next movie. I think it's going to be the 26th at the end of this year or sometime in late 2024 into 2025. It's time for a new one pretty soon after No Time to Die. That was Daniel Craig's last movie after 16 years in the iconic role. This will be, I gather, unless you count David Niven, I think this is the 7th 007. So there's a lot of symbolism going on here. Murray, when you look back at the success of Daniel Craig, I'd have to say that in some ways, he had a great run over his 16 years. He kind of re-energized the franchise in a way that I don't necessarily think people really understood when he was picked for the role.
Completely true. You've hit the jackpot with that one. The Craig series is really it turned into a story arc over five films, and I don't know if the producers just happened upon that or whether it was sheer luck. But Casino Royale remains, you know, one of the top five Bond movies. It is an excellent origin story. It really peels away the facade and shows how a regular MI6 agent becomes a 00. I mean, I still find that opening sequence and the teaser sequence in Casino Royale just fascinating. And each movie, as it went along, it really had something special to each one of his films. 2006 with the origin story, and plus one of Fleming's first novel, and a brilliant script and a brilliant plot.
Those are big shoes to fill. I mean, I liked Pierce Brosnan, and I had no problem with Timothy Dalton, but it didn't feel like since Roger Moore there had been really big shoes to fill, and it feels like Daniel Craig's are going to be big shoes to fill in this role.
I think so. That when they hyped No Time to Die as, you know, nothing like you've ever seen before, this is the one, they had to do something. You know, what else are you going to do but kill Bond off? So if they wanted to really make the hype of, like, you've never seen a Bond like this, they certainly succeeded. And I think the success of that five story arc with those five films and tying every little loose end together with a nice little Spectre bow, I think they're really going to have to dig into the vault and come up with something fresh, something clever, and something really, really exceptional for the next Bond movie. Otherwise, it could really affect the future of the franchise. And that's why the selection is so important. And I think Aaron Taylor-Johnson would make a great Bond. Right age, he's a Brit, very handsome, a little edgy. I think he'd be a great pick. So we'll see if all the hype is real.
If you could pick the next 007, who would you put there? Is Aaron Taylor Johnson your first choice, or would you, what a tough question, really.
I do like Aaron Taylor Johnson. I really like his look. Again, the other two that I would be very happy with would be Luke Newton. People mm-hmm. would know him from Bridgerton. I think my first choice would actually be Callum Turner.
Oh, interesting.
He's a little bit of a pretty boy, but I think that's all, Hollywood makeup. I think they could put him together and people would know him from the new George Clooney movie, Boys in the Boat.
Right.
So, yeah, very, very much the same look. But, any one of those three, I think, would be great. But who knows what we're going to see? We might get someone, you know, they'll announce a new Bond. We'll like, who's that?
Yeah.
Never heard of him. So maybe they're going to take a big chance, or maybe they're going to find, nothing comes to mind off the top of my head of a really established actor in his early 30s that people would know, you know, maybe someone like Jonathan Bailey.
Yeah, right. Cillian Murphy came up at one point, but he's just won an Oscar.
Murphy, so right.
I don't think he wants that commitment.
Cillian Murphy just seems a little bit too mousy for me. I don't know. He has very fine features, and true. I don't know. He just doesn't seem to have that rugged edge. But again, Jonathan Bailey also, I mean, he just finished that wonderful series with Matt Bomer called Fellow Travelers. Again, he would probably do very well in the role. I just don't know if they would make up him up to have a little more rugged edge. He's quite handsome, but Jonathan Bailey is probably one of those people who would be like, oh yeah, I totally know him, more recognizable, let's say, than Aaron Taylor Johnson, that people would buy and believe in the role, who might even be in the running. Who knows?
Murray, as always, your knowledge of Bond is always impressive. Thank you so much for your time. I guess we'll find out. We'll find out soon enough.
We'll find out soon enough. Thanks again, Ben. Have yourself a great day and a great week.
What is your name, please?
My name is Lisa Lane.
What is your name, please?
My name is Lisa Lane.
What is your name, please?
My name is Lisa Lane.
Once again, panel, will you follow along with your copies of this second affidavit? I, Lisa Lane, was a student at Temple University in Philadelphia 2 years ago when I became interested in the game of chess. Since that time, I have devoted 8 to 10 hours a day to the game. Last December, in a 5-hour match with the defending title holder, I became the United States Women's Chess Champion and won the right to represent this country in international competition next year in Yugoslavia. Signed, Lisa Lane.
That was from a show called To Tell the Truth, which I think goes all the way back to 1961. And of course, the premise of the show was they brought on three women, and one of them was indeed Lisa Lane, and the panelists had to guess which one was which. And they actually all got it right. Lisa Lane stormed into American living rooms. She stormed into the chess world first, but she stormed into American living rooms in the early 60s as the 2-time U.S. women's chess champion. At a time when chess was the domain of sort of rumpled-looking men, what was perceived to be scary Soviets and child prodigies, she cut a very different figure. In 1961 alone, she was interviewed on the Today Show. She was profiled in the New York Times Magazine. She appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and she was a trailblazer. She was whip smart. She fought for equal pay and against the establishment, the classism in chess. As one biographer put it, Lisa Lane showed the world that chess can be glamorous and that women can be as competitive as men. She got that. It wasn't just how you played chess, but also about the people you inspired with your moves. And it's believed Lane was in part the inspiration for the fictional Beth Harmon, played by Anya Taylor-Joy in that very popular Netflix series from a few years back called The Queen's Gambit. She passed away late last month in New York State at the age of 90. Her legacy, though, still looms very large. My next guest knows Lane's story well. She's also a 2-time U.S. women's chess champion, a professional poker player, and the author of a 2023 book called Chess Queens, which features Lane. Jennifer Shahade joins me now. Jennifer, thank you.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on to talk about this incredible legend.
Yeah, she really is. I mean, I think a lot of people may have seen her name pop up when The Queen's Gambit became so popular on Netflix, although there's some, you know, that may or may not be the case, but certainly it seemed to have been inspired by the likes of Lisa Lane. How did you first learn about her?
I first learned about Lisa Lane when I was coming up in chess. I'm sure my dad told me about her at some point. She is also a Philadelphian, and she's also a 2-time U.S. women's champion, although, of course, when I was coming up, I didn't know I'd be one yet. And she was a little bit of a late bloomer in chess. And it might sound crazy because I started getting really into chess in high school, but that actually is a late bloomer for championship contenders. It really is. And Lisa was even later after she graduated college. So to get super into chess at the age of 13, 19 or early 20s for her, and then go on to become a multinational champion is a bit rare, because what you'll usually see is people learn when they're like 5 or 6 and just like shoot up. So I feel like a lot of solidarity with her. And in particular, a lot of her very, very amazingly ahead of her time feminist points of view have really resonated with me in my career.
Yeah, it was amazing looking back at some of the things that she just the early 60s, and just, I mean, when you look at it in retrospect, she doesn't look out of place at all. But when you think about it in the context of when she rose and just the way she was, the way she spoke, the way she looked, and how good she was, she really broke down. Like, she didn't just sort of break down the barrier. She took a sledgehammer to it.
Absolutely. And I think it's still something that people are really struggling with, this idea of the gender pay gap. And she was really on that decades before anybody brought it up in chess, protesting the fact that the U.S. Women's Chess Championship title was at that time in the 60s, 10 times less than the U.S. Championship title. And while her efforts to achieve pay parity were not successful, I think the fact that she drew awareness to it was incredibly significant. And, you know, if it didn't benefit her directly, it definitely benefited future generations.
Yeah, I was amazed at just how popular she was, how well known she was at the time. I guess this was sort of the height of the Cold War, and chess was kind of a stand-in for some of that battle between East and West back then. But she was on the cover of Sports Illustrated long before Bobby Fischer ever was. Of course, he was just young at the time. We could talk about him later. But she was a going concern at the time.
Yeah, and I think in that way she was super ahead of her time now as well, because what we see nowadays is we have a lot of chess players who are famous not only for their skill at chess, but also for their ability to inspire fans from all over the world, their ability to communicate chess, both the beauty of it and the competitive nature of it. And I mean, let's be honest, sometimes it's just their personality and their looks, right? I mean, this is the world and now it's normalized. It's cool to be like not just a chess player, but a chess entertainer, a chess icon. But I think there used to be more of a stigma. People would be like, wait, why are you, you know, getting so much attention? Shouldn't the person with the highest rating ever get the most attention? And so there was stigma. And I think that Lisa was very brave and just like kind of embracing all of the attention. And I love some of her quotes. Like she said, I hate everyone who beats me. just she was really an icon.
Yeah, she said some incredible stuff over the years. I think at one point, Bobby Fischer, who has a kid, was, I mean, I don't know how it changed as he got older, was sort of notoriously misogynistic or said many misogynist things. And at one point, he said something about not wanting to play women. And Lisa Lane said, well, I don't like playing children, right? So it was, I mean, she could give as good as, I mean, she was at a time where she took a lot of sort of latent and overt sort of sexism was thrown at her. And she seemed to handle it with a lot of how would you put it? She could give as good as she got.
Oh, yeah. And she just was a really independent thinker. I like something that she said when people asked her if it annoyed her that they kept focusing so much on her looks. And she was like, well, they're not saying I'm a bad chess player and good looking. And I think that just like radical honesty was nice. Of course, I do think that women chess players, there's too much focus on their looks. But I also feel like every person has the, you know, agency to decide whether they like it or not, you know? And she was just like, it's all good with me.
Yeah, you would appreciate this too, because you've gone on, you're sort of a famous poker player as well. She's sort of tired of, at one point she starts to get tired of the sort of the game or all the, what goes around being a chess champion. She sort of starts to get a little bit bored of the whole setup as she gets into her late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, as much as it seems like she was a fiercely independent thinker and didn't care what anyone else thought, if you look at the actual things that happened in her life, you do wonder if there was some sensitivity underneath it all. Because one thing that really struck me years ago when I read about her was that she didn't like it when people asked her at parties what about being U.S. women's champion. She didn't like it when people asked, well, why is there a women's division when, you know, men and women can play together? I think it just became tiresome, you know, even like the TV show she was on where it was a big gag that such a beautiful, well-spoken woman was also a chess champion. I think these kind of tropes wore on her, even though like from the outside, she seemed to take it with so much aplomb. I think underneath it all, it started to get annoying. Kind of like having to defend her profession and her position constantly whenever she just met a new person.
Yeah. She went on to have a pretty fascinating life, though. She sort of got into environmentalism. She stayed in New York. She went on to have a really interesting life, period. Chess was just one, was sort of, I guess, the opening chapter of all of this. But wow, what an impressive after chess she had as well.
Yeah, that is true. And I think that a lot of chess players end up like keeping one finger in it, partly because of the relationships. I think, you know, she didn't end up marrying a chess player. And a lot of women, whether it's chess or poker or lots of games, there's such an unbalanced male to female ratio in these mind sports that it does seem there are many, many cases where the women professionals end up marrying chess players. And Lisa did not. And so she had more of a clean break, I think, than a lot of women in chess have. Also, it's just unusual because people kind of tend to, whether it's relationships or the game itself, people just tend to come back to it in some way, even if it's not as a professional. But she mostly resisted that, although it was really beautiful to see her be inducted into the U.S. Chess Hall of Fame last year and to be honored in the 2018 Sports Illustrated, where they really dove into some of her efforts for pay parity in chess at a time where suddenly it was normal and people were talking about it in all sports. So when I say she was decades ahead of her time, it wasn't just in chess. It was also in sports. The idea that women can be paid as much as men and that their games can be just as entertaining as well.
Yeah, she has a great line that she did play against one of IBM's early chess programs back in 1971 and beat it. And one of the great lines she says, it did not at least appear to resent losing to a woman, as do so many human male players, which was, I mean, she even by 1971, after she'd sort of retired, she was still fierce.
Yeah, that is a great line. Yeah, you think she would have been really good with like some of these like social media zingers, right? Yeah.
Jennifer Shahadi is with me. She is a two-time U.S. women's chess champion. She's author of a book called Chess Queens. One of those queens that she features is Lisa Lane, who passed away at the age of 90 at the end of February. She was a well-known and very popular, actually, women's chess champion back in the early 60s. And she broke a lot of barriers. She was sort of tall and elegant and well-spoken. And there was a lot made back then, of course, about the way she looked and the way she spoke, and that chess was really not associated with someone like that. And she was one of those early trailblazers who spoke her mind and was renowned for it before sort of retiring from chess as she hit her 30s. But she still sort of dabbled in it over the years. Jennifer, when you look back at the legacy that she left behind, it's interesting because the Queen's Gambit focused a lot of attention on women in chess, period. I don't know if for good or bad. I watched it. I thought it was pretty good. But it certainly allowed people to go and discover the likes of Lisa Lane again.
Yeah, it did. And I really do think that if you look at Beth Harmon and you look at Lisa Lane, you do see a lot of similarities in the way that they presented themselves in the game. There was also another woman that I feel had some inspiration in the Queen's Gambit. And that was Diana Lanny, who was another chess champion who took after Lisa Lane. So she came up after Lisa Lane. And one of the reasons she took up chess was because she was in a low income job. And she was working at a department store and I think making minimum wage and not really able to be independent on those wages. And her dad, who she didn't have a good relationship with in general, but she still is grateful to him for introducing her to chess. So he said, look at Lisa Lane, look at this amazing career that she forged out of chess. And Diana was inspired by this and ended up becoming a chess champion herself and having a very different life, partly because of chess.
Yeah.
So I think that's really powerful because, you know, one of the things that Lisa attacked in chess was not just sexism and misogyny, but also classism, right? The idea that in order to play chess, you had to be rich. You had to be rich enough that you could afford to spend your time and your money traveling and, you know, not making any income.
Right. Especially in America, particularly, I guess in the Soviet Union, it was all state sponsored, but absolutely, yeah. It was very much seen as a rich person's game.
Yeah, and that's definitely changing. I mean, it's changed. Lisa Lane helped change that as well. I mentioned Diana Lanny, but it's also more a part of the culture now that chess is seen as a public good. So there's a lot of educational nonprofits that support chess. There's a lot of schools that adopt chess. There are countries in which chess is like a mandatory subject for kids. So it's definitely, I think, still has some aspects in which it's classist, just because it's, almost any hobby is expensive at a certain level, and chess is not immune to that. But I think it's become a lot more democratized. And so that's another area in which Lisa was really ahead of her time.
Yeah. Jennifer, you stand on the shoulders of some giants, right? What's it been like for you? I know that you speak, you know, obviously this has given you an opportunity to have platforms to talk, to speak about these sorts of women in these kinds of sports and so on. You went on to play a lot of poker, which is another very, seems to me to be a very male dominated sport when I watch it on TV now and then. What's it been like now? How much different is it from the days of Lisa Lane?
Well, there's a lot more women than there used to be, and certainly girls. I think that where we see a lot of growth in females in chess is at the scholastic level.
Right.
A lot of girls play chess very successfully. In fact, some of the best chess players in the world, some of the best female chess players in the world in particular, are very young. You know, Judit Polgar, a couple decades after Lisa Lane, ended up breaking Bobby Fischer's record for the youngest grandmaster of all time, still holds some of the records for the strongest young player of all time. And I think that we've definitely seen a lot of movement in that area, but there's still a lot that can change for the better, you know, from the prize funds and the, you know, the power dynamics in chess, the amount of men in leading roles. And I think there's still much to be done, but it's quite different from Lisa's time.
Jennifer, thank you so much for your time.
Appreciate it. Yes. So thank you for taking an interest in the amazing legacy of Lisa Lane. And I'm sure future generations will thank her.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.